The road to new invention is uphill. There are curves and drops where they're least expected, and evidence of failed attempts colour the path. But as a self-help guru might put it, each unfolding opens up fresh vistas until, at the highest point, one can make out the way behind from the way ahead. And then there are higher hills to climb. In the 19th century, this landscape, the innovative heart of the Industrial Revolution, was the Silicon Valley of its time. Unlike Silicon Valley, a name coined for the once lush Santa Clara Valley of Northern California, Shropshire's new invention is a real place on an Ordnance Survey map, one with sinewy contours and dotted with archaeological markers of industry going back to Neolithic quarrying and Roman lead workings. The weather-lashed landmark of Clee Hill, a favourite for hikers, has coal at its heart and a mining history. During the Industrial Revolution, the intense pulse of warp and weft echoed around towns such as Church Stretton, then a centre of textile manufacture. Less than 250 years ago, these valleys resonated to the sound of steam and the cutting-edge machines it drove. People came from all over the world just to witness the birth of the industrial age. Today the blast furnaces are long cooled and visitors are drawn to Coalbrookdale as a World Heritage Site. As the museums of Shropshire gather the artefacts of 18th century technology, those of Silicon Valley collect our more recent responses to the urge towards faster, smaller, cheaper, reflecting the acceleration of computer technology. The 1960s computer age came out of the defence industry, swiftly followed in the 70s and 80s by the personal computer, which powered the dot-com boom of the 90s, all bound up in the ever-faster cycle of innovation, redundancy and discard. Just like the Jacquard looms and bits of steam engine on display in the British West Midlands, each wave of technological change feeds the Californian heritage industry, turning up a treasure trove for institutions such as the Computer History Museum. What started out in portable offices next to NASA Ames, the historic airfield off the freeway in Mountain View, is now an attraction which is an artifact itself. Its building was vacated by a tech company during the dot-com crash. The museum will politely turn down your average PC. Its collections committee has developed stringent criteria for its list of wants. They welcome any item more than 30 years old. The collection has material going back to the 19th century and not to the computer's long gestation, along with prototypes, rare machines produced in low runs, or homespun items made by someone who went on to contribute to computer history. Also mass-produced items with a low serial number, something which was a first of its kind, plus anything by a seminal inventor such as Seymour Cray of the number-crunching supercomputers, or which was a great idea ahead of its time and didn't sell. Such is the stuff of dreams at the Computer History Museum. Just recently it's acquired on a temporary loan an artefact which ticks all the boxes, a full-scale working analytical engine made to plans drawn up by Victorian computer pioneer Charles Babbage, but which he failed to make before his death. The funding for this and for another in the Science Museum in London was made possible by Microsoft co-founder Nathan Myvold, innovator and vintage tech enthusiast. Myvold's private collection, which I was fortunate enough to visit in Seattle a few years back, is a cabinet of micro-curiosities on a giant scale. Like so many, my first glimpse of future cyberspace came in green text on a black screen, with the cursor pulsing away like a dog waiting for the stick to be thrown. I learnt BASIC on a BBC Micro in the early 80s, at an evening class in a school hall. Other classes were in French and macrame. The binary premise was something I could understand. I was being taught to code, but it was the only way to use a computer. The words appeared in their own time, a Y or N for yes or no. Slow today, but in this Amstrad era, the brain felt that it was actually up to speed with the machine. Other mysterious coding was part of the machine's character. Feed it the right disks, and the heavenly blank screen, ripe for words, would appear. Just remember... Yes. The downside in those early days was the frequent swallowing of text in an equation, it seemed, which was the precursor to today's database frustrations. The probability that it would all disappear equaled time taken to hone the words, multiplied by the urgency to deliver them, plus the impossibility of reconstructing the flow to the power of 10. Hitting the screen made no difference. You delivered another publication to the Library of Lost Works. It was the techies from the old age of computing who took on the challenge of making computers friendly enough for non-techies to use them. Among their successors today are a special breed, retro engineers working on old tech with the benefit of new. They grew up with microprocessors, but transistors and tubes induce a warm glow. Ask them why it's all so fascinating, and they'll take you back to their first time. Let them get intimate with your own PC, and they'll take the back off in the hope of finding a maker's mark, some clue to link the artifact with its innovator. In the 21st century West, we live in a confusion of contemporaneous technologies, haunted by things that are micro and mini, a scale which diminishes the possibility that we can properly understand them. It was different once. In the 1920s, the director Robert Flaherty made Nanook of the North, a film about the Inuit. In a now legendary piece of ethnography, Flaherty reported that his camera broke, but what saved the day, and his film, was one of his stars, an Eskimo who'd never seen such a device before, but could make sense of this equipment and managed to fix it. As an archaeologist, I get a frisson when I hold a stone axe and look at its maker marks, the strikes, the bulb of percussion. Squinting, I try to imagine prehistoric man selecting the stone, shaping it, using it. In 1957, the American anthropologist Lauriston Sharp made some acute and relevant observations about a new technology white missionaries had introduced to a tribe of Aborigines, the Yeyerant, in Australia. This was a group whose social, economic and cultural lives were enmeshed in an outwardly simple concept, the obtaining, ownership and use of stone axes. The leap of technology was so vast that the Yeyerant could not absorb the potential of the new steel axe, which seemed so obvious to the missionaries. They assumed that being more efficient, its use would save time, so it represented technical progress. But, Sharp observed, the Aborigines didn't invest any such time savings in improving the conditions of life, nor in developing aesthetic activities, but in sleep. By suddenly introducing steel axes to a Stone Age community, the missionaries succeeded in rapidly breaking down a structure developed over thousands of years. I first read Sharp's study when I was a mature undergraduate studying archaeology and anthropology. Until then, I'd been a journalist, part of the early 90s process of newsroom change, which saw Remington typewriters heaved out to make way for monitors and keyboards, and carbon paper ditched for printers. Now at Oxford, I was back to pen and paper, but the case of the Yeyerant was a eureka moment. I could start to articulate my own frustration with technological change as it filtered from the exciting innovation into the baffling marketing hype. I acquired my first computer in 1996, a second-hand Apple LC3, which, even as I was handing over the cash, produced an unexpected emotional outburst from the vendor, who had written her doctoral thesis on it. I needed a laptop for library use, so I bought another second-hand Apple, a PowerBook with a rollball instead of a mouse. I never managed to master it. It became a rather expensive doorstop, whereas the LC3, possibly because I engaged with the journey, became my computer companion for the next 4 years. After that, I fell for the hype and bought a tiny Sony Vaio, lured by its trimness and mauve-grey case. In New York's best-known computer store, I thought I was clever, declining the device called a port replicator, which the salesman suggested. I was also alarmed by his reply to my request for a case for floppy disks. "You still have those in the UK?" Back in the UK, I was seriously under-resourced. I frankly hadn't a clue what I was buying or what it was for. I lost faith in that laptop too. And when I went to find some lost data on it the other day, this 8-year-old New Yorker did the equivalent of stamping its foot and storming out the door. I was left searching attic boxes for old printouts with holes down the side. If you're listening out for the L word, I won't disappoint, but it won't be what you think. For one thing, I don't regard Luddites as anti-technology. Going back to Shropshire and new invention, The Luddites rose up against machines which were the 18th century cutting edge in agriculture and weaving. They saw that an outwardly simple, skillfully designed device that increased productivity in one area would have ramifications in another. There would be a price to pay for faster, cheaper, greater. It's the comparable cost in computer technology today that's fueled my own quest to gather these tales of change over time. One interesting connection is that the early Jacquard looms had their warps and weft programmed. They were the precursors of punch cards. So how do we exist with technology? We techsist. We incorporate the technology we like or which works for us into our lives. We watch TV, we drive a car, we use a credit card that converts hours of work into electrons. We surf the net, we socialise by email, we hold video conferences. We shop electronically at 4 a.m. We rely on in-car guidance systems. We are surely and truly 21st century wired. In the autumn of 2001, I went to eat at a Lower Manhattan bistro. It was just weeks after 9/11. I got talking to the man in charge of trying to get technology back to the community college, who suggested he take me into Ground Zero to talk about the problems he faced. It was, as you'd imagine, a humbling experience to hear him describe how the basics, electric cable, generator, water supply, had to be cobbled together, and how gratifying it was when they worked in the middle of such trauma and chaos. The hands-on of low-tech came into its own. Since then, I've travelled expressly to gather stories about technology. I mainly use buses and trains, getting into hinterlands and rural areas. I've been the only person with a cell phone on a long-delayed Greyhound bus, watched my first DVD on a laptop on a train crossing Oklahoma, and entered my first virtual world on a farm in the Santa Cruz Mountains. From my vantage point, I find a multi-layered use of modern technology. This might give pause for thought to those who believe the modern world is divided into two camps, the wired and the so-called Luddites. There are more grey areas than the tech marketeers would like to consider. More people making choices and questioning how much technology they want to let intrude, their word, into their lives. So many times I heard people describe a fear of being left behind or left out. The word impotent often used to describe the situation where they knew less than their partner or child. There was fear of technology, especially in the middle age range, where the accent had been on generations younger or older, and decisions to be made about using and owning cell phones, video cams, or entering chat rooms, and generally engaging with a world which seemed alien and yet was part of their own culture. I myself am a 40-something female who was a late adapter to modern technology. I'm constantly fascinated by innovation, but baffled by maths. Though practical, I'm frustrated that I can rarely fix anything. I'm left thinking that maybe the dissatisfaction we feel in our modern lives is down to gadgets that work against our natural, primal instinct to use our hands in the real rather than the virtual. Back in California, there's a new vogue for making. The Maker Faire is drawing the sort of people who went to the early computer meets of the Homebrew Club. Craft is back. Thread a needle, cut cloth, sew. Thousands of miles from Silicon Valley, in the rural heartland of West Mercia, where the folded hills and valleys are historically shared by England and Wales, technology is evolving in better ways to bring in the harvest or to deal with livestock. It's moving on in its own fashion, surrounded by phone masts and wireless connections. In the fields, the farmer calls his cattle not with some electronically generated howl, or the tweak of an embedded device in the tail, but with his own voice.